So welcome everybody. You have landed once again at the USDLA Free Friday webinar series, and we're excited to have you today, whether you're watching live or in the future. We're welcoming you and we're so glad you're here. We've got a really interesting topic today. I was so excited when I discovered Pamela on the internet, and so she was gracious enough to join us, and I will talk more about that in just a moment. But first, just a couple of quick announcements, just to remind you, if you did miss our last episode, we did have Hannah Howell in. Those replays and many of our other replays are available at USDLA TV, our YouTube channel, which is fairly new but rapidly growing. So please head over there and check it out and subscribe. We've got all sorts of topics and categories over there. We've put our distance learning roundtable recordings that some of you have been watching for a little bit. Those are available there. So it's one-stop shopping now. You don't have to go so many places to find us. In just a moment, I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Guzman. But first, I do need to just remind you, we do have some other upcoming things happening and let some people in the room. I always love this part. I always picture people like rushing in the doorway. So there we go. We've got more friends joining us today. We love that. So again, we have some other upcoming events. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Seth Flatower back with his colleague, Travis Moyer, and they're going to be talking about AI and teachers and student and wellness. I know we've talked about AI from sort of the technical side a lot, but this one's going to be a little different. So come back and check that out. We're also going to have Sheila Fry back from the BAB group. And after that, we'll have another recurring guest star, I guess you could say, Lisa Clark from Anthology. And she also is going to be touching on AI because we are doing a series of sessions about it. And if you come to the conference, you can learn even more about AI. But what we love is we have people tackling it from all different angles. We have people who are doing research around it. We have people who are going to give you practical information about building your prompts and all of those things. And it's nice to hear it from different perspectives, I think. So check that out. You'll notice on the screen that you do, if you're able to join us in St. Louis, we do have a discount code. You can get 10% off. Also, I should mention, while we are going to be on site in St. Louis, we do have a number of virtual components to the conference. We will have a virtual day on Tuesday, June 4th, and a virtual day on Tuesday, July 2nd that are part of the conference, as well as a number of sessions from within the conference itself will be streaming out. Things including some of our keynotes. We'll have Don Mann. We have Joe Sallustio and Robbie Melton as some of our featured speakers. You can go to the website and learn more about what they're going to be doing. And also, we'll be live streaming our annual award ceremony. We have, I believe, 18 award winners this year. If you subscribe to the newsletter, you got a list of those and you got a chance to preview who they are. You'll also be learning more about them in the coming weeks. So, hope you can join us at the conference. But even if you can't, please keep coming back to the webinars because we have generous sponsors who make these possible. So this is the last thing I do need to say, a big thank you to them. You notice on the screen, these are our gold and silver sponsors. Again, they make these webinars and our conferences possible. So if you work with any of these groups, please reach out to your rep and talk to them and say hello and find out what's coming. Let them know what you would like to see coming. They love to talk to you. And then also, just don't want to forget our bronze sponsors and some of our other friends and exhibitors that we've been working with. So I have taken up enough of your time, and that is not today's webinar. I apologize. There's today's webinar. I'm going to stop sharing for a moment, and I am going to turn things over to Dr. Pamela Gomes. And I am so thankful that you agreed to join us today because you have a topic that I was so excited about because I saw the word libraries. I know we have a lot of people in our community that either are librarians or love libraries. And we all want to learn more about an aspect of distance education that not everybody talks about. And I noticed when I started posting on social media about your session, I got a number of really interesting messages from people who were like, "That sounds really interesting. I never thought about that." So thank you again for being with me today. And I'm going to turn things over to you and I'll just fade into the background now. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Valerie, and I'm really delighted to be here and talk to everybody today. And as Valerie mentioned, I'm Pam DeGuzman. I am not a librarian. I always love to start with that. I'm actually a public health nurse and public health researcher at the University of Virginia and the nurse scientist for UVA Health in Charlottesville, Virginia, which actually plays a lot, believe it or not, into the background of how I got interested in this because we are a semi We're like a small urban area, like plopped in the middle of rural Virginia. And so the patients that I've cared for 30 years tend to come from rural areas. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Sure, you can see that. Okay. So I'm going to start off in telling you about a patient named Clara. Clara is a 58-year-old breast cancer survivor, and she lives not far from here on a farm in beautiful rural Madison, Virginia, which is outside of Charlottesville, where, of course, where UVA Health and UVA Health Cancer Center are located. Over the weekend, she experienced what unfortunately is a familiar pang of anxiety for her. She had a dull ache sort of settling into her shoulder, which, of course, is a nagging reminder of her past battle with breast cancer. So she called the office, the oncologist's office, and spoke with the nurse. And the nurse recommended she probably needed an appointment with the oncologist to really fully evaluate her pain just to be safe. And although Madison, where Clara lives, is only about 40 miles from the cancer center, because of the combination of the rural roads that she has to take to get to a main road, and then coupled that with the city traffic she has to encounter every time she comes into the cancer center from out of town. It takes her well over an hour to get here, and that's not even including parking. But in addition to that, Clara only has a farm vehicle, and this means she often has to rely on her daughter. And her daughter is, of course, a working mom whose own child has some special health care needs, and her daughter has to take the day off from work to come with her to her appointments. So the nurse, of course, heard the hesitation in her voice, and she quickly recommended, what about a virtual video visit so that she could just conduct the visit from her home without taking one of her daughter's really precious PTO days? Well, Clara, of course, was grateful for the suggestion, but she also knew there were a lot of reasons she couldn't do a telemedicine visit. And most people, I'm sure, on this call and on this webinar know that reliable internet access is a challenge for a lot of rural residents, but not everybody might realize that the digital divide is related not only to the equipment that we use to connect, but also to people's comfort with the technology. And Clara has email, she has Facebook, but she typically connects those to those from her public library where the librarian is available to help her if she gets stuck. Now, Clara's situation highlights the ongoing challenge of ensuring equitable access to care in rural areas, but also a growing solution that we're going to talk about today, which is telemedicine in public libraries. Now, again, the people on this call probably are familiar with some of this data. This data that I've got up here came out of the Pew Center. It's a couple of years old at this point, a few years old. It's from 2021. And this left graph is the percent of adults who say they have or own home-based broadband in the country, and that is divided out by rural, urban, and suburban residents. And what you can see on here is that in 2021, only 72% of people in rural areas said that they had access to home broadband. And of course, access doesn't mean that you could even stream a video or a video visit, but at least it gives us a starting point. Now, you might look at that and think, well, only 77% of urban people have it too, and 79% of suburban. But It might not seem like that big a difference, but it is a big difference when you think about other ways of accessing broadband. I live in an urban area, Charlottesville. It's a small urban area, but even where I live, 10 minutes walking from my house, I can get to three, four, maybe even more places that offer free broadband. I can get to McDonald's, the public library, the county office building, all these different places. And if you live in a suburban area, it's probably the same, maybe not in walking, but within 10 minutes, you can drive to a Starbucks, to McDonald's, to a library, any of these places to access free broadband. And it's just not the same in rural areas. And in fact, in a lot of rural areas, the library is the only place to access free internet. And the library, of course, has another advantage over a place like Starbucks or Taco Bell, which is they have private spaces. Now, on the right, we also see smartphone access. And we know that, like, often people are like, well, you can just get, access on your smartphone. The smartphone has a video, and 80% of people in rural areas, according to this, have a smartphone. Although the problem is that just because they have a smartphone doesn't mean they have access to Wi-Fi. And so they can't necessarily access a digital video signal. So they're left with just being able to do a phone call if they're doing this type of visit and not going in person. And then, of course, the last thing that we've already alluded to, and I'm going to talk about a little bit more, is this issue of digital inclusion, which means that even if we provide broadband equipment, a computer or a device, and a high-speed signal, many rural residents lack the skills to use telemedicine because they are not using these devices every day, the way many of us are, and we call that digital inclusion. So before we go too far, I do want to talk a little bit about definitions because when I talk about telemedicine and telehealth, I realize most people, even within healthcare, use these terms interchangeably, but they actually have really distinct differences. And just to kind of orient people to the way I talk about it is I use these definitions. Telehealth, I have my little Venn diagram here, sort of the big circle in the Venn diagram, and that refers to any use of electronic information, telecommunications technology that supports long-distance clinical healthcare. This could be emailing your provider. This could be anytime you get like an X-ray or a retina scan or an MRI, that information is typically loaded and sent to your provider over a digital signal. Those are all considered telehealth, or provider-to-provider virtual consultations is telehealth. Telemedicine is the smaller circle, and that has a very discrete meaning, which is the delivery of discrete real-time, so synchronous care delivered virtually. It's like having an appointment, but you're doing it over technology rather than face-to-face. And then within the circle of telemedicine, there's actually one more distinction I like to make, which is the video visit. When I talk about telemedicine in this context, I'm actually referring just to video visits. Now, you might be thinking, well, what else is there where we're doing direct real-time patient care virtually? And of course, the other way to do this is through a phone call. And before telemedicine video visits, phone calls were largely how we did telemedicine and what we considered telemedicine. But now there's been this huge surge of video visits, and this is the part where the equity issues really start to play a role. So I'm going to start by telling you how I got into this, because as I mentioned, I am a nurse and I'm a nurse researcher. And back in 2019, I was doing a research study where you see the back of the head of our wonderful nurse who delivered this intervention for us, Alan Cupp. He and I partnered and partners with several other people from our cancer center to test the ability of us to deliver care to rural cancer survivors, much like the example that I described at the beginning of this. And you can see him on here that he is demonstrating this for, I don't know if you can see in the right-hand corner, is a little bit of the logo from the TV station that came and filmed this. And he's demonstrating how we did this because in 2019, believe it or not, this was considered a really novel way to deliver care. Today, we don't think so as much, but back then it was newsworthy. And so the news station came out and did this. Now, it's interesting with this study because this has really got what got me headed onto the track of telemedicine. Because when we started this study, we absolutely knew that our rural patients would not all have access to Wi-Fi or the equipment to be able to stream a digital signal and a video signal and to stream with the provider, who in this case was Alan. We anticipated that. We asked them about it on the front end. We did, some testing to see if they could do it. And if they couldn't, we would mail them basically an iPad. So it's my iPhone, but an iPad where they could do it, and it had like a little stand so that they could see it. And we sent them the instructions for how to do it, which were written as we typically do for these types of things, and sixth grade language so people could understand it. We thought we had it nailed. We never anticipated the difficulty that we would have with people understanding how to use the equipment. Because remember, this was pre-COVID. This was before people were really doing this a lot, and we just didn't know that it was going to happen. But of course, we now know that if people aren't using these devices every day the way so many of us are, that they don't have the skills and the literacy to navigate it. And this intervention was really about reducing distress for cancer survivors. And what we realized was, in some ways, it was actually increasing their distress because they had so much trouble connecting. And I have this wonderful quote from one of our rural survivors who participated in our study, who said, "It was just not connecting." And that's just nerve-wracking when something doesn't work and you're trying, And she was so persistent. We eventually did get it to work for her, but it took a couple of different visits to get it to go. And she just wanted to talk to the nurse and not have to come in to see him. So with this, we really started thinking, how can we do this in a way where people can get the help they needed? And of course, we pretty quickly thought about libraries, because libraries really, when you think about it, are a perfect fit for telemedicine. And a lot of that is because of public librarians who are essentially just these incredible community servants. Interestingly, this public health urgency about making telemedicine more accessible for rural populations had well been around since COVID. People started really thinking about it with COVID a lot more, but the calls to increase accessibility of telemedicine were already there. It's just that no one had really done anything about it. And even libraries, in some cases, had been proposed as solutions, but no one had tried it. And you can see why. In a lot of communities, they are often the only public computer and internet access for underserved populations, people who don't have this at home. And we know that they can reduce those geographic and transportation barriers, which can be considerable. A lot of our patients that come in spend all day, and some of them traveling from really far away, even spend the night here. And I am sure in more rural states, in the Midwest and in the Western, Northwestern United States, it's probably even more so than in Virginia. Another thing that people probably don't think about is telemedicine in a library can also serve as an alternative place to do a visit when the home environment is unsuitable. So if you can imagine somebody who maybe has a lot of children at home and it's just very distracting, or in the case of someone who's maybe subject to interpersonal violence at home, they may need a private space where they, and so telemedicine isn't going to give them that. They have to go all the way in to see their provider to get their privacy, but not in the case of a public library. Now, back in 2020, when we started this particular research study, I'm about to tell you about before COVID hit, I think we actually started it in 2019, so we published it in 2020. We just wanted to know, was this even possible? Could libraries support this? And we did a survey around Virginia. We collaborated with our Virginia Rural, excuse me, our Virginia Library Association, and we reached out to libraries all over the Commonwealth of Virginia. And you can see them all identified here by these little gold pins. And I've also got the counties identified by their rural status. So the green and the yellow are the more rural areas, whereas the orange, the pink, and then the lilac are the urban and suburban areas. And what was so great about this research was that we found that libraries had the ability to support telemedicine. Almost 90% of them had public space. They had high-speed internet, and they had equipment. They had everything they needed in most cases. But for me, even more importantly, what we discovered was that the rural libraries had just as much of this equipment as the urban libraries. We did not anticipate that. We thought that rural libraries would not have the equipment, have the space, have the high-speed internet at the same rates, and they did. So this was a really exciting thing that we found out. So, of course, what happened next, everybody remembers, is there was a pandemic and the clinics closed their doors. Well, almost immediately, a couple of places around the country began opening up telemedicine programs in their public libraries. Not very many, but we do know that in places like Pottsboro, Texas, which is northern Texas, in across rural communities in Delaware, and actually in urban Dayton, these were three of the first ones that came out that we knew about and started doing telemedicine in libraries. Now, you may or may not have heard of the program in the Dayton Library because it's not as often discussed because it was an urban one. Now, if you remember back to the pandemic, the early days, almost every clinic closed their doors because we did not know what was happening, and we switched everybody to telemedicine visits. And if you couldn't get into telemedicine, if you didn't have the ability, you were kind of out of luck unless you had one of these places around you where you could do it, or a friend or a family member. Well, in the case of Dayton, what happened was they had a group of providers that were serving people with substance abuse and use issues and addictions treatment. And these people needed to stay in seeing their providers. But in this urban area, a lot of people did not have the ability to see their providers over telemedicine because access is an issue there too. Not everybody has access to these digital signals in urban areas. And all these places were closed. Dayton libraries, even though the library itself was closed, partnered with this whole group of providers that provided this substance use and abuse and addictions medicine care. And they said, we will exclusively offer these visits to people in your program. They can come in, library's closed, but we will let them in. We'll give them a room. We'll give them a computer. We'll set them up. And they actually even continued doing this once the library reopened. They kept this room available for them. And so that was a really great example of this in an urban area. As you can see, though, the implementation of these programs started very slow. And when we started to study the existing programs in late 2020, we actually only found five across the country. There were probably some more, but this is all we could find. And we were looking everywhere for these programs. So I'm going to switch gears for a second and talk to you a little bit about diffusion of innovations, because that is what we're talking about. Now, I would be surprised if people that are listening to this or are here on the webinar haven't seen some version of this. It's a very popular way that we explain the adoption of change or the adoption of innovations in any setting. And of course, this work comes out of the work of Everett Rogers, who actually studied the way that farmers innovate in terms of looking at things like hybrid corn or seed that is pre-treated to be resistant to bugs and things like that to have better crops. But the important thing that Rogers found was that he found that no matter if you were looking at the adoption of things in the farm community or in the healthcare community or the business community, that the way things are adopted, new things follows a consistent pattern, and he created this bell curve of how innovations sort of roll out and how they're communicated. Just to kind of orient you to his graph, on this horizontal axis, we have time. So, of course, this is early over here in this corner, and this is late over in this corner. And on the vertical axis is the number of people that are in the group that have adopted at any point in time. What you see, not surprisingly, is at the very beginning in this corner, we have very few people that were adopting, which is what we saw in telemedicine libraries, just a few people. And there's a good reason for this, because if you are the first person to jump into this, you're jumping into the unknown, and it can be extremely risky. Whether that's for, in this case, maybe financial outlay, spending time, whatever it is, or in other things, there might be other risks, like the early people that got, for example, COVID vaccinations. There wasn't as much data about it, and so these people tend to be very risk averse for whatever reason. They are willing to just jump in and do it. And what's important is that as you grow this group of innovators a little bit, they start communicating about what the risk is and their successes, such that once the initial risks are known, you get this group called the early adopters. They hear about it from the innovators, and then they begin to adopt. So they're less risk averse. They're still a lot less risk averse than overall, but not quite as risk averse as the innovators. And once they hear about it, they will take it on. What's important about the early adopters is once they do it, then you've got this, almost a third of people are adopting, and you begin to get your majority. Once you get your majority, it's really easy to get to the rest of the people. But you've got to get through this early adopter phase first, and then again, communicate all of this information so that the majority who are more averse to taking on the risk are much more comfortable doing it. So we're going to come back to this a little bit because this is really important with telemedicine and libraries. So of course, what we wanted to know early on, because we were thinking about it in terms of diffusion of the innovation, is what are some of these risks? And we did this study with these early adopters at these five places, that we could find. And one of the, actually, I apologize, this was not the five. This was actually before that, when nobody was adopting it. We went out to public libraries in rural areas, and we just said, what would it take for you to do this? Like, what are the reasons you're not doing it? What are the barriers? And we found out that they had a very common theme, which was money, financial resources. Rural libraries have very, very limited budgets. In fact, small and rural libraries, the budgets are actually annually around $100,000 a year to cover everything, if you can imagine that. A lot of them have one employee. They rely on a lot of volunteers or donations. And even those donations count into that budget. They also have competing priorities, and those priorities are other things in the community that the community needs because they are so engaged with their communities. And so, if they're going to take even a few $1,000s to do something, it's taking it away from something else that's another priority. And as you may know, libraries are continually asked to do things in their community because we always think, oh, what about the library? The library could do this. And so, they have to figure out what their priorities are. And the last thing that is definitely a resource issue is their space constraints, because of course, a lot of rural libraries are very small. They don't have private spaces, or they may have one private space. If they take it away for this, they're taking it away from other uses. And in fact, one of the earliest adopters, actually, all she had at the time was her office. And so she just said she just set people up in her office to do their telemedicine appointments, but not every place can do that, and a lot of places will get kiosks. Those kiosks are probably $6,000-$7,000 today to get to put in a space, if you even have the room for that. And I love this quote from one of the people we talked to, where this librarian explained, like, we are not state-aided. Not every library is. We don't even have any dedicated funding source through tax revenues. And my biggest challenge is making sure that we have enough money just to keep going. So you can see how adding even something like this that they wanted to do was a big risk if they couldn't figure out how to get the money for it. So one of the first problems we had to solve was helping people understand how to resource this. Now, the wonderful thing that happened next was this lovely young man who some of you listening to this, if you're from the library world, will probably recognize Nick Martin. Nick Martin is an innovator. He actually is an entrepreneur, but at the time when COVID hit, he was the technology consultant for the Delaware Public Libraries. And he said, we can do this. And he innovated and he did it. But he did so much more than that because he started the National Work Group for Telemedicine Libraries, which we're going to talk about more later. It lives on today. This was a group, I think when we first started, it was probably around 20 or 30 people. It's since grown to over 100 of people that really just wanted to understand how to put telemedicine in libraries. He brought speakers in every month. He let people know about funding resources. He let people know about the ways that they could share successes and failures. And by doing this, reduced a lot of the risk because libraries know how to write grants. They just had to know where to go to get these grants. And a lot of money was available at the time through the CARES Act. So he really helped push this forward. Interestingly, since then, Nick has had to move on because, as I mentioned at the beginning, he was an innovator and an entrepreneur, and his actual company, which is something called Carbon Reform, that has nothing to do with libraries, he ended up having to work on that full time. I shouldn't say having to, it's his passion. So he has since left that position, but his legacy certainly lives on. So you're thinking, problem solved, right? We've got the money from the CARES Act. People know how to apply for it. They're getting this money. Implementation is increasing. And so we are in a great space, right? Well, not so much because a lot of these programs were not successful. And I know of several programs where they got, large, 20, 25,000 grants or even smaller grants, to be able to do this, but were not successful in the sense that people were not utilizing it. So you could put all this stuff in there, but if people aren't utilizing it, you're not connecting your community with the resources. And so, of course, as a researcher, I wanted to know why. And as I'd mentioned earlier, we talked to these initial programs. We did a research study with the first five programs that we were able to find in 2020, and we began to analyze the data to understand what differentiated a successful and an unsuccessful program. Why did some programs have people coming in and some didn't? And we wanted to know, does it have to do with rural versus urban, or maybe the geographic region that they're in? Is it because they're partnering with community entities, which we knew some were and some weren't? Is it because you have enough money available to implement? I'm actually just going to tell you right now, that is not the trick, believe it or not, because you can have money and have it still not work. We wanted to know, what about the way patients are learning about this and accessing these services? So we looked at these five places and we did find that of the five that we learned about, they were pretty scattered all over the country. Interestingly, we didn't really have any in this upper sort of Midwest and upper Northwest area, which today those are some of the most active and successful programs that I'm aware of, probably because they're large rural areas. There's very active NNLM and telehealth resources out there. So those today are actually doing pretty well. But at the time, we looked at these five that we were able to find in all these different regions. And indeed, the region does not really seem to matter in terms of them being successful. I'm going to talk a little bit about the type of access they have. So let me explain this continuum that I've put up here. The type of access refers to how does the patient get into a telemedicine visit at the library? And I've got it on a little bit of a continuum. With this end is accessing it through the library only. So this means that if I want to do a telemedicine visit at my library, I need to contact my library and say, I need to make an appointment in your telemedicine room. And they say, sure, we will book you. And then I show up and they help me that way. Provider only means I can't call the library. I have to go through a provider. And this is, as in the case I explained about Dayton, where the only providers they were working with were these mental health counselors, addictions medicine counselors. That was the only way to get in, was if you had your appointment through there, they would say, we can actually schedule your telemedicine visit if you don't have telemedicine at home through the Dayton Library. And hybrid, of course, is a combination of the two. I just call it hybrid because it means they had both. They had some providers that they could schedule, patients could schedule directly with, and they also accepted people to sort of just walk in and say, I need an appointment, even if the provider wasn't part of their partnership that they had. On this access, we evaluated the level of coordination with other groups, whether that was a provider group, a community group. And on the left end of, or the lower end of the continuum, is really minimal to no coordination. This means that, like, you were kind of on your own as a library with figuring out. There was no community agency like coaching you, connecting with you, helping you, all the way up to like a true partnership. And again, that would be an example of that would be this Dayton Library, where they just had this relationship with this provider group and they did everything through that provider group. So we analyzed and we realized these were the two things that really mattered. We analyzed this through the lens of these criteria. And so we looked at three different models. Model one is minimal coordination, where you only access through the library. This is what I call the throw your doors open to the world model, where a library gets their funding and they buy their equipment, they set up the room, they spend their money on that, they maybe advertise it through their, local Facebook group or whatever. But that's kind of it. That's kind of all they're able to do is just say, we are here. Please have your visit here. Model two is the Dayton model, where it's only the provider that you can go through. And it's very, it was a really strong partnership. And typically, these models would have to have a strong partnership in order to be a provider-only model. What we found, though, was the other three, and what we now are seeing is the majority of successful partnerships is this model three, where, yeah, they're opening it up to anybody, but they are also working through a provider. However, the level of coordination with the partnership or partnerships is very, very high. And this is what we found, was that the most successful programs were rural programs. You'll notice I greened this one over, and I'm going to explain that in a minute. Were programs that had high levels of coordination with a dedicated partner, whether or not they opened up to sort of the community, which a lot of places do because that's they want it, what they want to do, but it's this level of coordination and this collaboration with provider groups that really drove people through the front door. Now, I covered this one over with green because we noticed that the programs that worked that were in rural areas were more successful in the long term. So back to the Dayton program, hugely successful. Then the library reopened. They kept these rooms open for people that wanted to do it. But guess what happened? The clinics reopened, and then all of a sudden, this was in an urban area, and so it was just as easy for people to get to their appointment and see their provider face to face as it was to get to the library. And we believe it's because that ability to get to the provider, because they were in an urban area, made this not needed anymore. And they had so few appointments that after several months, they ended up just closing the program. It helped, it was great at the time, but on an ongoing basis, the places that really need the telemedicine actual in the library seem to be those that are in rural and remote areas. I'm going to look at my notes. Okay, so where are we today? What is the biggest barrier to adoption today? And some of you probably already know the answer to this or can guess based on that last slide. The biggest barrier we have is learning that they need to partner with the healthcare community and then learning how to partner. And so we are overcoming that with a few strategies. And when I say we, this is the community of people that are really trying to get telemedicine and libraries up and running. And so the first strategy really is under the network of the National Library of Medicine, who has just been an incredible partner in this. They have this course through one of their certifications to become a certified health, to have a health library certification. They offer this course called Telehealth 101, What Libraries Need to Know. And they promote this content. They promote the research that we've done. They promote the need for partnerships. Also, I have had some partnerships with NNM leaders, particularly George Strawley in Region 4 at conferences to spread this knowledge. And a lot of other people are doing this, but NNLM has really taken the lead in helping get this information out there directly to the librarians that want to do this work. The second strategy is the telehealth and libraries pre-implementation workbook. So early on, probably in 2021, when we analyzed this data and realized that these partnerships were going to be critical, I partnered with the Indiana Rural Health Association that was actually working with a library that was having some difficulties getting this up and running. And I said, here's what they need to do, but we need to get this information out. And Indiana Rural Health Association, actually, we had a faculty member from University of Southern Indiana, who's also, that's also in a rural area. We all partnered and developed this workbook where we essentially took the research that's been done and distilled it in a very easy to use sort of step-by-step workshop workbook. You'll notice we call it pre-implementation workbook because we're really trying to get librarians to think about in advance, what are the partnerships I have before I even buy my equipment? Because we want them to do a community health assessment or at least understand from people in the communities that have done a community health assessment, what are the needs? Because not every community is the same. Some like Dayton need mental health care. Some may need more like specialty, cancer survivorship or something. So before they even go out and purchase things to figure out what is needed, who are the providers that want to partner with them, who are their providers, patients that they're seeing that this would help for. I'll just put out there, as I know a lot of people who are listening to this know, this is a free resource. We developed this because we saw the need and we wanted to fill it. There is literally zero other agenda to this. Please download it and share it. There are no revenue streams that go to anybody. It is completely out there for people to use. We do ask if you have any feedback about it. We developed this with people from the National Work Group of Telemedicine and Libraries with their input, but we want to know if people are using it. Does it work? How does it work? Does it not work? What do we need to change? We just want to keep it as the best possible resource for people to be able to use and promote this information. Finally, the third strategy I mentioned earlier about Nick Martin at the Delaware Library, and that he ended up exiting his role at the library to be a entrepreneur at Carbon Reform, which is his first love. Well, he turned over the National Work Group for Telemedicine Library to myself and George Strawley, who's with NNLM. And so what I've done recently is tried to really reinvigorate that group. We've got a LinkedIn site. We share all the news, all the initiatives, developments around this. And again, if you think back to that strategy where we have to kind of move from those first movers, those innovators, to the early adopters, to the majority. Communication is everything. So we just are trying to get this out there as much as possible in hopes that eventually it will really start to bubble up. Now that leads me to ask, where are we today? And you've probably already guessed the answer to this. So We are still on this curve pretty early on. And there's no sciences other than mine just putting the arrow here, but I do believe that we have started with the early adopters. We have minimized some of the risk. We have got the information out there, but we are still, I mean, there's maybe, I don't know, 100 places around the country that have done this out of 7,000 plus libraries. And so we've got a long way to go till this at least, gets into the rural areas, which, I will always keep doing this work because I always think back to those patients that we are trying to serve with that first research study and trying to connect people. And I know that those people are still out there. They still need that help. And so I'm not going to stop until we are all the way through this curve with telemedicine, at least in rural libraries around the country. So I'm going to end there, and I can take any comments or questions or anything.
Well, I just first of all want to thank you for being here and thank you for a great presentation. I was scribbling notes faster than I could scribble. So anyway, that's just me. But yes, I will. I'll just first of all thank you. But I also, yeah, I mean, some of the things that I thought, one of the reasons well, first of all, I put the links in the chat that you had sent me for the working group and for the resource. So I'll just draw people's attention to that. And we will also share that in the, in the replay notes and all the places. You'll have
Thank you.
access to the links if you miss them while you're, in the chat. That's okay. But yeah, just so much of this was such an important thing to me for so many reasons. One was it applies, your focus is rural, obviously. And that obviously is a population that needs special attention, and I love that it's getting it. I loved your map of the different regions. We've had some other board members and speakers talk about grants for rural areas, and we've seen those similar maps. So I'm hoping that also people who are recurring viewers of these webinars are starting to see these patterns of equity issues and that it's overlapping in different ways. And so while today we're talking about it from a telemedicine and libraries perspective, we could have replaced the word telemedicine with, just school or, like so many other things. So I hope people are hearing that, and I hope people are hearing the wonderful examples you gave of things like Dayton, where they were being creative with their space. And that's something that's my wheelhouse, is helping people to think differently about how we do things. So I'm hoping that you'll take away, some of you will take away some ideas, even if this, again, you're like, well, I'm not a nurse, I don't know anything about this part, but you do know about sharing information, creating inclusive and equitable opportunities. Maybe you're in an urban environment, and so the library is where people have to go and reapply for Medicaid. Like that, if they don't get to a computer, they can't get their health care. So there's other pieces to this. Some of you might, if you go back in our archives, you might remember our friends from Arizona. The focus there, obviously, there's a lot of rural areas out there, but also tribal communities. And they talked about how they used the chapter house. Thank you. There's the word. It's Friday. Sometimes words don't work for me. How they use the chapter house, similar to you're talking about the library as a meeting place. So again, take all of these wonderful comments from Dr. Guzman and say and go, oh, okay. This is the piece that I need to focus on, because this is what I have. And I'm just looking at my notes real quick because I was trying to think of the other things. I love the fact also that you clarified some definitions for people, because I think people do use a lot of these terms, or they're not sure what term to use, and they're just, I don't know what the difference is. I don't know. It's tell us something to do with something, doctors and stuff.
Well, even in
So
healthcare, people use those terms interchangeably. Most
yeah.
people, I just clarify them so people know what I'm talking about when
Exactly. But I mean, even those kind of things I thought were so valuable today. And just the assumptions that people are making about all of these components. So I'm checking to see if there's any questions. I don't see one at the moment. You covered everything so beautifully. That's the problem. You didn't leave any questions for us. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I also love the fact that you addressed that this is an ongoing adventure, and we're going to have to adjust and see what's needed. So like with Dayton, and you're getting messages in the chat saying you did a great job. So see,
Oh,
I'm not the
thank
only one who
you.
said that. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's also just a message for all of us in whatever aspect of the distance world we work in, is that we need to always be adapting and changing to the needs of our population, whatever population that is. So if the clinic's reopened and they can get to the clinic, then maybe that library staff can be adjusted. I do have a question though, which is in terms of the library staff, because as you said, many of them are operating on a shoestring and it might be one person. Did you get any information from them about like how is this like feeling very stressful to them that like we're adding more things? I know we're hearing from like teachers, like, oh, this is just one more thing that, even though it's important and I know they want to do it, is there, did you get any sense of sort of that aspect of it?
Yeah, that is such a great point. I do think that, librarians are the ones that decide to do this. And so I think if they're making that decision, it's probably not stressful. What I believe is from, the research that we've done and just my knowledge of people in the library field is something I alluded to earlier, which is every time somebody needs a solution in a community, they say, oh, the library can do this, or, and then that's when it starts to feel, I think they get very put upon. And there are a number of people that I talked to, in my research to say, would you consider doing this? And that's when this idea of competing priorities came up. It's like, sure, we'd love to, but we can't because we only have so much money and these are the priorities that we have to deal with. And I think it's really important. I've learned so much about librarians through this process, which is people always say, like, nurses are the most trustworthy. In my mind, librarians are actually need to be a step above in people's esteem because these are true community servants. I mean, that's the reason they do this work. They're there for their communities. They want to help. And I do think there's a lot of pressure because they are so dedicated to their communities. And, we need to have grace with them too, to know, like, we need to make this as easy as possible. We need to help them find funding. We need to, have these partners to take some of the pressure off. Part of the reason we want partnerships is like there are places in communities that are trying to do this work and can hopefully do some of that heavy lifting, put the equipment in, run the, scheduling, whatever it is that they need to happen so the library can just do what they do best and serve their community without having to do absolutely everything.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. 'Cause yeah, I'm hoping, who knows, maybe somebody's listening to us today and they'll be like, "Hey, I could help. I could help them." Because that is something that, I worry that they do try to do everything for everybody, and they are, I agree. They're right up there. My spouse and I joke about park rangers are also on that list of like, they're
Yes.
just like, and like I thought that was an interesting assumption, or interesting finding, I think. Your assumption that rural communities might not have the bandwidth, they might not have all of the same that technology part of it, and then the fact that they do, I think that's wonderful. That one did not surprise me, however, because I used to go hiking a lot, and the fire towers have the best Wi-Fi for obvious reasons, because they need to know when something's going on and they need to communicate it. So I'm happy to hear that the libraries at least have that if they're not being as loved on and funded as we would like them all to be. Yes, another reason why social workers and libraries are help like yeah, social workers, libraries, nurses, you all like just are natural, I think, natural fits together.
But social workers and libraries is like a thing that I didn't even know about till I started this work. And I got connected with Beth Waller, who's has done the majority of the research on developing those programs. And it's absolutely true. Like social workers being another group that is just there to serve people and having them be able to come to the library and help out with this. Some libraries have community health workers that can do that. Again, you have the funding for that. Someone has to fund it, but all of these people can help and take the pressure off. And we also need them to help, kind of raise the funds for it as well.
So yeah, another reason, again, one of the reasons I love doing these webinars is just bringing awareness to some of these things. Like I said, I'm thrilled that we get to help to get the word out about what you've done with the workbook and the work that you're doing. But yes, I mean, libraries, I don't have all the information, not my specialty, but I've heard that, even, people who need to have like their glucose monitored, that there are certain libraries in certain communities that have equipment. Maybe you need to have your blood pressure checked. Maybe you need to have some things like that. So again, just there's so there's yeah, we could gush all day about libraries, couldn't we? There's so many great things, but I guess the point here is my bottom line is please go learn more about what's going on in your communities. See how you can perhaps be of service if that is something that you feel called to do. Speak to your, I know a lot of you are at higher ed institutions. Talk to your librarians there and find out about partnerships. Many of your institutions have health services colleges, which are obviously natural fits here. So all of those things. I'm thrilled to get the word out. I'm just taking a peek, see if there's any more questions, comments. But again, thank you so much for being here. I will stop the recording in just a second, but I don't kick people out immediately. So don't worry, you don't get kicked out of the you don't get kicked off my lawn. I don't do that to people. But thank you, Dr. De Guzman, and thank you for everybody who attended with us today and will be our future viewers out there in the cyber places. So thank you all again. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and please come back and visit us again at another webinar, or even better, come visit us at the conference. I don't think I have anything on rural telemedicine at the conference, but we do have someone coming in who is an expert on working with first generation rural students, getting them into universities, and the special things that needs to be thought about in terms of that. So anyway, thank you again for being here. We will see you next time.
Right. Valerie.